And welcome back to Soundside. I'm Libby Denkman, and we're continuing our series introducing you to new members of the Bruce Harrell administration. Maiko Winkler Chin is the executive director of the Seattle Chinatown International District Preservation and Development Authority, which owns and manages affordable housing and works on economic development in the neighborhood. Earlier this month, Harrell nominated Winkler Chin to be the new director of the city's Office of Housing. And I met up with her in the International District over the weekend, where she has worked for 17 years on housing issues. We sat right outside of her office in the Bush Hotel at a picnic table in Hinghe Park. And you might hear sounds of saxophone and several games of table tennis or ping pong just a few feet away. And we started talking about her background. Maiko Winkler Chin was born in Japan, grew up in Hawaii, later went to college on the mainland at the University of Puget Sound. And that's when she says she first fell in love with Chinatown International District.
I remember coming here because my very, very good friend in college is from Beacon Hill. And I came home with her on a weekend, and she was going to a dance at the Nippon Kan Theater, which is just up the hill from here. And we were staying at her parents' house on Beacon Hill. And we came down 15th Avenue from Beacon Avenue, turned to 12th and Jackson and came down. And it just felt so good to be here. So Jill's family is Japanese American, got to eat all kinds of my favorite Japanese foods. And it felt very comforting. And I thought all of Seattle was Beacon Hill, Chinatown ID, and downtown. The fact that I never saw the University of Washington didn't quite hit in. But I was like, oh my gosh, this is great. And we went to this dance up the hill, all Asian Americans, people of color. And I was like, oh yeah, this feels like home.
Okay, so after the dance, Maiko ends up working in the neighborhood, working on housing issues in the International District. And as I talked to her, our conversation moved into what she's been doing for almost two decades in the ID and the unique opportunities and challenges of creating and maintaining affordable housing and healthy neighborhoods in Seattle.
So the PDA does property management of both residential, almost all of it's affordable housing that has city or state or federal regulations, as well as manage properties, spaces that have the community clinic, the parks, the U.S. Postal Service, small businesses, restaurants, all of that, right? Just a variety of different commercial spaces. We do a little bit of real estate development and are becoming more active. We did some rehabilitations over time, but really starting to do a couple of major developments right now, not in the district, nearby the district. And community economic development. So it's working really with the small businesses or with the property owners and the landlords. In this neighborhood, we have very high rates of poverty. You know, we're always talking about in the housing world, these AMI levels, 30% of AMI, 50%, 60% of area median income. We have a high rate of seniors and a high rate of poverty. The seniors around here are probably making about 12% of AMI. So even though housing is considered affordable, it's not necessarily affordable for you, right, in some ways. We have long-term residents here that live here for a long time, and they really rely on this neighborhood in a very different way, perhaps, than others, especially if you're language-bound or language-limited, and who you feel comfortable with, and where can you get your groceries and all this. So this neighborhood has a lot of amenities that really serve people that are probably limited English speaking. You know, we've got grocery stores around here that sell a variety of different types of foods. We've got the clinic, the International Community Health Services. They serve people in a variety of different languages. It's kind of the microcosm of just a small town. So we have 2 and 3 bedroom apartments, and we've got studios and ones. And the longest standing resident that we had in one of our rental apartments, 34 years. We've had families that moved in before they were families. It was like a single person or a married person, and they've had children, and now their children have grown up. So our residents tend to live here a long time. And I think if residents are really tied to a geographic area, a community, I feel like sometimes in the city we tend to believe that renters don't care. These renters care. They've been here forever, right? And they want to stay. So how do we allow them to stay because it's beneficial to them and they build those connections? and can help each other and keep themselves strong. And then we love places like this.
What are the challenges that you have seen, and what are the opportunities that you have seen in Chinatown International District in your 17 years, and how did you approach them?
I think what I see is I'm sitting here in this lovely, lovely park and looking around, is some of our buildings really are undercapitalized, right? They need to be repaired because they might be vacant on the upper floors, and they're really, really expensive. And that was tied back to the city policies around the Ozark Fire in the 70s, when there was a fire downtown, killed a lot of people, so we need to sprinkler and do life safety improvements, but those things are expensive. And so as I think about Mayor Durkan, one of her final things that she did is work with Councilmember Herbold on unreinforced masonry work. So what are the unintended consequences of that? Most of the buildings around here, because we have so many historic buildings, are unreinforced masonry. In areas that aren't historically preserved, you could tear those buildings down and rebuild. You're not going to be able to do that here. What does that look like, and how much does that cost? And that's a problem that we're going to have to work through at the city. And what are we going to do in order to help preserve the businesses that are in them? Some of them may have residents, some of them won't. And is the type of ownership that's there valuable to us? Do we think it's important? I have a preference for buildings that are owned by community members. I do, right? I know who owns these buildings, and when something happens and you want to do something, how do you support each other? How do you help each other? Without that, I think there's a loss. Those ties are really, really important, I think. I think, because that's a sense of community there.
How do you foster that in a city where we are seeing so much change so rapidly, and a lot of real estate development is not necessarily locally owned? I mean, how do you foster a community investment and, where you can, local ownership?
The city has a couple of policies that I think are really important. So some of this is like really wacky nerd talk.
We love wacky nerd talk. We're public radio.
I know. So everybody, take a look at your dang comprehensive plan that's coming up, right? We're going into comp plan updates. For me, what it means is that in the last comprehensive big plan update that we did, we started acknowledging displacement risk and opportunity, and was so happy that we did that, because as HUD, federal HUD, started doing its affirmatively furthering fair housing stuff, and due to some court rulings in Texas, started panicking a little bit because they were making it sound like we couldn't do investments here in this neighborhood because of our high concentration of poverty. And for me, that was really, really important to get that opportunity language and have the city do the opportunity language with HUDs, because we're a high opportunity neighborhood, right?
High opportunity meaning?
Access to education, access to jobs, close into transit and all this. But we're also one of the highest risks of displacement, because those things that make us high opportunity, because we have such low-income people, because we have such low rates of home ownership, I think we have 4% in this neighborhood, all those things set us up as high risk of displacement as well. So it's a double-edged sword. So that's kind of one of the wonky things, right? And just really think about how you make those investments. But I also think, from my experience in putting together some of the real estate projects that we do here, if we're making an investment in the housing, there's typically commercial space on the ground floor. And what should that look like? What are the other needs of the city? So working on two projects right now that have childcare centers. One has a program of all-inclusive care. The other one, we've really thought about trying to make small commercial spaces. But who are those commercial tenants that should be there? How do we prioritize certain types of businesses? Really just kind of looking through and figuring out, how do we allow the people that are living there or used to live there to come back? How do we work on commercial business spaces that reflect the community? I think that's really, really important. I know that housing dollars don't go into community spaces, and we have a limitation on the interpretation of the state constitution that everybody's like, whoa, we can't invest in commercial spaces. I think we have to think through how you do that, because I feel like those spaces really reflect the neighborhoods. We did neighborhood planning, I think, in 1996. But what do those plans look like now, and what do we need to do, and what are the additional tools necessary, right? And I do think neighborhoods really, really change over time, but how do you stop the loss of the essence of what that neighborhood is?
Gentrification is always going to be a huge concern. How do you think the city can preserve equity as it grows?
I think gentrification is really, really tough in a neighborhood like this one, because one of the things I know from working on Asian Pacific Islander issues is when you look at API communities, I'm doing the bell curve here, we look pretty good with all the stats, but actually we're not a bell curve. We're kind of like a bowl where we've got really, really poor people and we've got really, really rich people. And if you mush us all together, we look just great, but we're not.
And data doesn't always tell the whole story.
No, I mean, can you tell me a little bit more? What does this mean? What's the source of the data? Is it the right data? Because we should be working towards data to make sure that our assumptions are true. But you always got to kind of question.
When I think about obstacles to affordable housing, the funding model comes to mind, because I know you have to pull together a lot of different sources, public, private, and you have to have organizations or people that know how to navigate a very complicated system. So it's funding, it's, you know, finding real estate that's available in areas where people need to live, so they're close to their communities, they're close to their jobs. And then it can be NIMBYism, you know, locals being not so fond of the idea of more density in their neighborhood or of affordable housing that might not improve their own home values. What do you see as the biggest obstacles to affordable housing in Seattle, and how can obstacles to affordable housing be overcome?
Libby, I think all of what you mentioned is true. And I feel like sometimes we're all looking for that big old silver bullet that's going to fix whatever. I have never found that silver bullet. It's always been cobbling together a variety of different things. I think clarity on certain things are really, really important. So, for example, when I go to the city and I'm putting together one of my housing projects or one of my developments, right? Do I really need to go to five different departments or whatever many that is to figure this out? And as I'm going through one right now, I'm like, why am I getting this piece of information at this time? Is there a way that we could have done it earlier? Like, can you give me a roadmap? Oh, okay, I'm on a roadmap. Oh, I just got hit by a truck because this thing just popped out of nowhere. And did it have to come then, right?
But that can be the experience of so many people who work with local government, right? They get frustrated, whether it's opening a business or building a housing.
Oh my gosh, yes. Because why does it take like a change of use to take like 8 months, right? Oh, you mean everybody has to wait like this? I thought it was just because it was me and somebody was angry with me, or because I didn't fill out the paperwork right, or they were so busy. I think living through the work, I think, is really important and valuable. So if anything, as I head into this new job, I've worked with the Office of Housing for 25 years. So what are the tools? And I feel like I can ask all these questions now and just be like, can you tell me why we do it this way? And I tend to ask a lot of questions. And just because that's the way that things have been doesn't mean that that's the way that things should be.
But you'd be coming in as somebody who has navigated the affordable housing process with the city. You've seen shortcomings. You've seen a lot of hoops that maybe once you're inside, you'll be looking to find ways to consolidate or remove.
Well, yeah, I like simplicity. Having a parent that doesn't speak English, simple is best. I mean, you know, you're just like, okay, how do we do this? Because it's not like we don't need housing that's affordable for people at all different income ranges and of different sizes and types and styles and meeting different goals. Housing is not the end goal. Housing is just there to stabilize you so you can go on to do other things. And, you know, we have a real push right now, wealth accumulation in the African American community. Okay, that can be in housing, which is the main way that our country has typically set up the way for people to build assets over time, you know, through small business ownership. What does that ownership look like? What does stability look like? Housing is a tool that gets used for a variety of different things. It's not the end, in my mind, it's not the end goal. It just kind of sets you up for other things.
This is not just a Seattle problem. This is a regional problem. This is a state and really countrywide problem, the housing crisis.
Yeah.
But in Washington State, the estimate from the Office of Financial Management is that we need about 250,000 homes built like yesterday to meet the housing need. What we're doing right now is about 40,000 plus per year in Washington State. In your position with the city, of course, you have certain levers that you can pull, but it's also about working with other entities, right? The state, state legislature maybe. What kinds of things are you looking at and hoping to tackle when it comes to, it might be supporting statewide legislation, it might be working with other leaders that includes other areas, not just Seattle?
So because of the projects that we've worked on, we've had to work with the state. We have State Department of Commerce funding. We've also worked with the Washington State Housing Finance Commission, a small but powerful agency. They're the ones, because we do low-income housing tax credits and we use 501c3 bonds for the development of community facilities and whatnot, they are about to reach their debt capacity. So it's like, okay, what do we see as the need? How do we increase what we get? What's the risk of increasing? And where is it that housing is built and what type of housing? But then also Amazon and Microsoft are starting to do these housing investments and they're doing them on the east side. But it is that conversation about, okay, what are those resources looking like and what can they do and how do we build that? But this is a statewide problem. I mean, when I started here 17 years ago, the population was very different than it is now as to who's looking for affordable housing. I knew Capitol Hill was getting priced out because we were getting baristas down here. I'm like, oh, where are you guys from? And you all speak English, so I can help you. Can I take your application, right? Over time, you see who comes into the office, and you're like, wow, the need has really grown and changed over time. You sit in this park, and you see the neighborhood change. You're like, wow, you never heard about, like, Whatcom County needing housing. Affordable housing is a major problem here, and we don't get to grow, and we don't get to stabilize. Our families aren't supported unless you have housing that's affordable to families.
It strikes me that you're coming from an organization who's been on the ground in a community, you know, as a landlord to affordable housing, developing new affordable housing, but the job you're moving into is a political job in a lot of ways. Did you think about that when you were considering whether to go ahead with this and how different your life is going to be being in politics now and having to navigate a whole new set of constraints?
I did. I had to have a conversation with my husband. I had to have a conversation with somebody that I'm working very closely on a project with because I wouldn't want my departure to kill that project. And then it also came down to impact, right? I'm getting old and there's just a lot of work to be done at the city overall. It's about the ability to do that impact. Is it political? Oh, heck yeah. Is this the best time to be in a political job? I don't think so. But at a certain point, you can only complain so much without trying to do something different, right?
What are you most excited about in the new position? What are you most excited about tackling? And you talked about impact. What are you most excited about making an impact? What areas of housing in the city?
The Office of Housing is lucky that it gives out a chunk of resources through its capital dollars for the building of affordable housing. Where is it? What should that look like? Is it 4-bedroom units? Is it 2-bedroom units? Is it studios? Is it to work on the homeless problem? Is it to help workers that live in neighborhoods such as this? And then we have a housing levy coming up, which the City of Seattle residents have always supported putting money towards the building of units that support our seniors so they can age in place and be in healthy places like this, right? Or for families. I mean, how do you, in really using that housing levy? And that's something that we should really be proud of because it's one of the greatest programs in the country for the building of affordable housing. We are so lucky. And I think if you work here, you should be able to live here. And we are a community that supports that. And we should. We need each other to survive and to thrive and to live the life that we want to.
Thank you so much for meeting me here and talking with me. You know, as you move into your new political job.
If I move into it, right?
If you are confirmed.
Gotta get confirmed, yes. Thanks, Libby.
That's Micah Winkler-Chin, the executive director of the Seattle Chinatown International District Preservation and Development Authority. Seattle Mayor Bruce Harrell has nominated her to be the director of the city's housing department, pending city council approval, of course. And you heard her mention the confusion and drama around the affirmatively furthering fair housing rule that was created during the Obama administration, repealed under President Trump, and now reinstated by President Biden. The rule is complicated. Opinions about it do not fall along partisan lines, and we will be doing more reporting on it going forward.